numbers. It's like 5. I think it's 5.
Okay, this is Shabbat 5. Last week we discussed the concept of melacha.
Sean, you want to do me a favor? Can you just close that door? Do you mind?
Yeah, we oh, actually, Scarlett, you sent me the other one. We you're sending me old ones.
Yeah, I caught up.
Okay, this is not helpful for what I need. So we discussed the concept of melacha. I don't want to use the word work anymore because I think it's misleading. It seems to imply physical exertion of labor, and we discussed last week how it has nothing to do with physical exertion of labor. I can run around and schlep chairs and set up tables, and like by the time Shabbos is out, I'm like tired from physically exerting myself, and I haven't really worked. Because what really is work? So according to Schuyler, and I quote, "Malach is defined as constructive work, work with a purpose, as differentiated from the Hebrew word avoda," which was good. I didn't say that last week, but it's very well said. Avoda is just like avoda, like in Israel. If you go today, you went like, did you go to work today? That's called avoda, right? Mm-hmm. The categories of malach are derived from the activities of the ancient Israelites undertook to assemble and disassemble the Mishkan during their sojourn. That's a fancy word, during their sojourn. It's very biblical of you. During their sojourn in the desert after the exodus from Egypt. These activities have been expanded and generalized to encompass all productive activity whereby we assert our mastery over the physical world, modifying it and shaping it into our desired images and forms. Now, why are we modifying and shaping things into the forms that we want? And is that a good thing? It is a good thing, we discussed last week. We want to do that. Does God actually command us to do that? God wants us to engage in that kind of constructive, productive activity all week. Because what is our task as human beings? Not really a Jewish thing, per se. It's a human thing. To do what?
Because
what's that?
Be productive.
To be productive? Who was actually commanded to do this?
Adam.
God said to Adam, the Hebrew word is vikiv shuha, which means to conquer. To conquer the forces of nature and make the world a better place. God purposely created an imperfect world. And our task was to perfect it. And that's what we do all week. But one day of the week, we pull back. And these activities have been expanded. During the week, we perform melacha upon the world, expressing the divine spark within each human in our own personal microcosms of creation. We didn't discuss that last week, but you really touched on something very deep there. Because when the Torah says we're created in God's image, okay? So we're created in God's image. What does that have to do with being productive? Because God's a creator. And we're supposed to emulate God by creating as well. So we're not anti-creating. You know, just because we're resting on Shabbos. It just, there's a time and place for everything. Right? By contrast, on Shabbat, we refrain from performing melacha in recognition, observance, and emulating of Hashem's having refrained from creation on the first Shabbat after the first six days of creation. By the way, as an aside, if anybody wants to listen to the podcast that I just released, I met with, or I discussed with Gerald Schroeder. Has anyone heard of Gerald Schroeder? He got his doctorate from MIT. He taught at MIT. He's a real legit physicist. He's been teaching in Eshet Torah for many years. And I just bombarded him with a lot of these very important, simple, basic questions about the Torah and the first 6 days of creation, Shabbat. He has a very different take than Rabbi Dr. Natan Slifkin. He very much believes that the way the Torah sequences things is really giving over science, and that there is a lot of depth in that. You just have to be able to understand what the Torah is saying, because it's not literal. Rabbi Slifkin was very much of the opinion that none of the 6 days of, you know, they're just theological ideas. It's not really giving over science. It's giving over values. It's really interesting to listen to if anybody wants to hear, and I have my third one coming up. Lastly, I want to get into cooking, so I'm just rushing. Moving tables and chairs, serving a meal, and other activities we perform in pursuit of Oneg Shabbat do not seek to modify the world at large. See, that's it. That's it. I have not changed or done anything different when I move this chair from this point into the other. Now, if I move it into a public domain, I have, because we discussed last week, that's called carrying, and that it belongs to a different sphere, not manipulating the natural world, but the social world, the world of society, the way we engage in our just relationships with each other in business, even in pleasure. We move things from one domain to the next, and that is why we refrain from carrying on Shabbat. Moreover, the unusual ways in which we prepare and enjoy the Shabbat meals highlight the difference between Shabbat and the remaining 6 days of the week. Okay. Any questions about this? Because I want to get into what I want to spend the rest of the tonight on is one particular melacha. I picked this one because it's very practical and relevant. But is there any questions just about melacha in general, the 39 acts of work in general? Question. Yeah, Barry.
Kind of a random question about this sort of thing. Are you allowed to, like, without a screwdriver, put, like, a screw through a, like, section where a screw is supposed to go through?
In other words, there's a hole in the wall already?
Well, no, and technically underneath my bed. Let's say, like, there's been times where it falls out and I need to re-screw it through the thing. Is that allowed on?
The screw is in there already?
It can get loose and then sometimes it falls out.
So that's a very good question. What's the only possible act of work that could fall under?
Striking a final blow.
Okay, good. It could be. That's called in Hebrew, by the way, that's a really good phrase to know. It's called the makeh b'patish, the final hammer blow. Like if you're in a fight with someone and they say something really terrible after, you'll be like, that was a makeh b'patish. You know, you just like, that's like the whatever that broke the camel's back, you know what I mean? Like that's the last thing. So it could be that. It also could be what else? Could be fixing. The reason we don't use musical instruments on Shabbat, even though they did in the temple, very interesting, is because, but Miranda, are you able to hear all this? Because there's like a really weird delay on me, but you can hear okay? Okay, good.
I have laggy, but I catch on everything.
You catch on everything, okay. I love the pictures behind you. They're great.
Oh, thanks. They were painted by my cousin.
Oh, very nice. They're very pretty.
You're not allowed to fix them.
So you're not supposed to fix things on Shabbos. So this doesn't happen often on drums. It happens more often with a guitar. It happened to me on one gig where I put a drumstick through one of the skins. And then I had to, you know, during a break, change the skin. But, you know, guitar strings break. And that's a rabbinic decree because we're not supposed to fix on Shabbat. So the concern is that if you're using something that easily breaks, so that we stay away from those items on Shabbos just to make sure that we don't come possibly to... Now that's a rabbinic category. But one of the 39 acts of work is fixing. So Barry, I think it could be makeh b'patish or fixing.
Okay.
If you were to re-screw it in.
Yeah, okay. Then no fixing.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's very complicated. Yeah, Allison.
Why couldn't you play something like a flute
that doesn't break? So there's a concept in halacha called the flutes don't break.
I don't. They're just like
if you keep it into well tuned.
Like it doesn't have a reed.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I played the chalil, so I know what you're talking about. You know the chalil? It's like such a whatever. In Hebrew school, they always have the chalil. It's like a very Israeli thing, or like a harmonica. It's not going to break. So there's a concept really of lo plug, that once the rabbis forbid a certain category of something, they don't start saying this one versus that one. You know, it's just generally off limits because we're just concerned. Then you start using your own calculations. This one should be okay, this one is not okay. But you'll see, when it comes to cooking, there are biblical aspects to the prohibition of cooking and there are rabbinic aspects. But that's a good question about musical instruments that don't require.
But also, like, I've heard it, like, referred to, like, a bicycle. Like, you'll be riding a bicycle, it'll break, and you'll need to fix it and leave the bicycle there. But if even if I was playing an instrument and it broke, I could just leave the bicycle.
You could, of course. It's not that, listen, this whole category is called muksa. So you see that Skylar has a pen over there. So you put the pen in your pocket. Right, I'm not allowed to write on Shabbat. That's one of the 39 acts of work. How did that become one of the acts of work, writing? What did they do in the tabernacle?
Didn't they, like, write, like, the pieces go together?
Yeah, you ever build a sukkah? So how do you know, like, what piece goes into what piece?
You mess with it every year until you figure it out.
That's what Jews do. Real, like, construction workers, Jews hire somebody else. Real construction workers will put a little X over here and a little X there, and they know this piece goes to that. That's what they did for the tabernacle. So here's the thing. So we're not supposed to write. So the rabbis came along and they said, we're concerned that, and the rabbis didn't make this up, they were authorized by the Torah to enact legislation to ensure that the Torah's laws themselves would not be violated. So if you were one of the great sages of the Sanhedrin and you wanted to make sure that your brethren didn't inadvertently write on the Sabbath, what would you do? You'd say, no more pens. Don't handle pens. Now, you could say, Alana, what you just said, I'm a very disciplined person. And I can carry around a pen, I won't use it. Now, it's no different than saying that the speed limit, which is, let's say, 55 miles an hour or 65, is done for the average person who's probably not a professional race car driver. If a professional race car driver were to get on the road and say, listen, I go 120, 130 miles an hour. I can go 85, 95 on the freeway. The cop's going to pull him over and write him a ticket. Why? Because you can't have a legal system that works for here and works for there. And in Hebrew, it's called lo plug. You can't differentiate. So you're right, and I can't really give you a good answer because you might be disciplined enough not to inadvertently write with a pen and still carry it around, but you can't really have a viable legal system if you start having these kinds of chilukim, these divisions. Yeah, Barry.
Another question.
Any other parts of your bedroom we can help you with? Yeah, I'm just kidding.
More in my pocket. What happens, like... I'm kidding.
Barry just comes here to get his own... Yeah, please.
Well, it's really like a question I've had for a while about Shabbat. Let's say Shabbat's already closed.
Yeah.
You're walking, wherever, and then you realize you forgot to take the money out of your pocket.
So you have to find the closest MGE, one of our three sites. Just kidding. So what do you do? How much money is it? Is it a decent amount of money?
Let's say it's a really small amount. Is it better to throw it out?
No, you should get rid of it, but you should do it with, if you're a righty, use your left hand. If you're lefty, use your right hand. Why does that change anything?
It's like out of your just like habitual...
Right, because what did we say last week the definition of malacha is? You actually knock it down a notch. You knock it from a biblical prohibition to a rabbinic because it's not intentional or deliberate. Because a righty uses their right hand, not their left.
Ellen. What if you're like not sure where's the line with that law of using your left hand for things? Like I've been in situations where someone's like, "Oh, I'll use my left hand for the elevator," but it's like, "No, maybe we should just wait."
So you can't use this anytime. You can't be like, "Oh, I'll just do everything." It's called the shinui. The shanut means to change. So like you see people. And it's definitely better, like if you're going to press the elevator button and you're a righty, it is better to use your left hand. It is not as much of a prohibition. It's not, I'm being honest.
Is it lesser to use your elbow?
It's the same thing. As long as you do it in an abnormal way, you can do it with your left pinky on pinky toe. It doesn't matter, as long as it's not the normal way you would do it.
Flip the guitar around and play lefty.
Can you explain the concept?
Of Shinui?
No, that it knocks it down a concept, I get that, but that if you're doing it the way that you don't ordinarily do it, why is that some...
Okay, because it goes to what we said last week. What was the definition of malacha? An intentional, deliberate, productive kind of work activity.
Yeah.
When you do something in an abnormal way, it already plays around with the definition. It's already not exactly what the Torah is prohibiting.
But it is intentional and extremely.
It's intentional, but it's not. It's a good question. You're trying to fine tune exactly, because if you do it with a shinoi, you do it in a abnormal way, and it's not the normal way you're doing it. Then that is. Because the whole thing is about refraining from manipulating the environment in the way we do it all week. And if you would do it all week with your right hand, now you do it with your left. Now, I'm not, don't walk out of here and go, Rabbi, I can do whatever I want as long as I use my left hand. Right? I'm not trying to say that. But it does knock things down a little in a purely technical sense. Now, I'll tell you when we use these things. You're stuck in a car. You didn't plan properly to get to a certain place before Shabbat. Okay, and now you're in a cab. Now, I did say this. Next week we're going to do this, please God. We're going to have a class on non-Jewish help on Shabbat. Okay? And we're going to give all sorts of leniencies of when it's okay to rely on a non-Jew Shabbat. So we said last week, or a few weeks ago, that the 30-minute gap, twilight, because there's a big debate amongst the rabbis, what is twilight? Does it belong to the day before? Or is it the next day? Therefore, that 20-30 minute period is knocked down. Anything you would do is only on the rabbinic level. And therefore, if you have a non-Jewish friend around, you could actually ask that non-Jew to do something otherwise that would have been forbidden for you to do on the Sabbath. Okay? So let's say you're driving in a, you're in a cab, you're in an Uber, and you know the driver's not Jewish, and you didn't plan properly. Do you have to, like, get out? I mean, ideally you should get out and not continue to be driven around. But because it's Bein HaShemashot, because it's twilight, and the person driving is not of the Jewish faith, you could probably stay in the car for another 20, 30 minutes. However, when you get out of the car, what's the problem?
Closing the car door.
Opening the door, number one, and then closing the door because you set off the light. So there...
Screw the light.
What's that?
You disabled the light.
You want to do that on someone's Uber?
Oh,
now, we do that in...
It's the Uber element of it.
Okay. Yeah. No, we do that in our refrigerators. That's what we do. I usually tape it so that when we open it up, it doesn't inadvertently go on by itself. But nobody really knows if it's going off. Has anyone actually been in there long enough to know? It's a very deep question.
You can put your iPhone on record.
But wait, so why am I giving this example? So let's say you're stuck in the car, and now you want to get out of the car. And now you know by opening up the car door, you're going to be inadvertently turning the light. Now, it happens to not still be a biblical prohibition. It's rabbinic. It's not biblical because you're not opening up the door for the light. You're opening up the door to get out. The light goes on. That's still rabbinically forbidden, but not biblically forbidden. And doing it with a shinoi, with a, you know, like your left hand as opposed to your right, or vice versa, whatever you are, knocks it down another notch. So the more you understand the structure of all these different rules and laws, the more you can manipulate the system a little. Not to get around, because here's the thing, you don't have to be that intelligent or creative to figure out a way today with timers, light switches, and all this stuff to basically have everything done for you. You don't even need your non-Jewish friends. Okay? You could have the TV go on for this show at this time. You could have the this and that. You could have the car. Your Tesla will come and pick you up and drive you to this. It's not. We're not so far away. I remember when I was a kid, I used to watch the Jetsons. And that was, like, all that stuff in the Jetsons is all happening now. Right? But you're only, we're only fooling ourselves, because this is what gives us the sanctity of Shabbat. I'm only talking about extenuating circumstances now. Okay, let's talk about cooking. So why is there a prohibition about cooking at all? Anybody know? Well, why was there cooking going on in the tabernacle? Who was cooking? The Kohanim were these great chefs.
They put a lot of things go up in smoke.
What?
They put a lot of things up in smoke.
Yeah. Take a look on the source sheet. The Mishnah, that's part of the oral tradition, enumerates the broad categories of labor prohibited on the Sabbath. The primary labors, the Avos Melachos, are 40 minus 1, which is a fun way of saying 39. And then it goes into sowing, plowing, reaping, gathering, threshing, winnowing, selecting, grinding, sifting, kneading, baking. What's that for, guys?
Bread.
What bread?
The show bread that you would put in.
There were show breads in the tabernacle. Good. What was the last act? And if you want to actually create bread, the last thing you do is you bake it. But the first thing you do is you have to start playing around with the soil. Then you got to put a seed in. Then you have to do this. You can actually go through all of these 13, these 11 acts that go into baking bread. The other thing they used cooking for was... No, I mentioned it very quickly in passing last week.
Melting the metals was considered...
Very good.
Yeah.
For, no, not melting, but for the dyes, D-Y-E-S. Remember the... They would... No. They had hangings in the tabernacle that would divide the different sections called the parochet. And in order to create the dyes for the tapestries in the tabernacle, they would... It's the same malacha. It's the same activity that went into creating the dyes. They would cook them.
So even though the intention is different, we're not eating the tapestries.
Good.
We still...
And by the way, we're not even eating the show breads.
Right.
You know? Also, they were for show. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily matter what they were being used for, but what does matter? The actual activities. So what's the activity of cooking? If you had to give me a definition... Now, what's your definition of cooking?
Can I back you up for a second?
Yeah, please.
You just said that the reason that it was a rabbinic prohibition to get out of the cab was because you weren't intending to turn on the light. But that doesn't hold for the bread or the dyes or the tapestry? Like, the intention doesn't matter there?
That's a great question. But you are intending to create bread. In other words, you and I are intending to create bread. And our ancestors in the tabernacle were also intending to create bread. Okay?
What we intend to do with the bread
doesn't matter. What we intend to do with the bread doesn't matter. It's the activity. It's a very legal thing in terms of the... Yeah.
Was there no truma in the desert? It was only after they got to the
temple. Truma? What does truma have to do with this?
The Kohanim were not having to have truma made from them in the desert.
You needed to have crops and an agricultural society. They didn't have that until they went into Israel. So I assume not. That's a very good question. There were no jobs. No one had a job in the desert. He's talking about the fact that when the Jews went into Israel, everybody worked and owned land except for the Levites and the Kohanim. They were sustained. They were supported by the people. That was called truma. That's why we wash our hands before bread. Remember? Why do we wash our hands before bread? Because who would wash their hands before bread? The Kohanim, before they would eat the tithe, the crops that Jews would give them to support them. The food itself was considered what's called in Hebrew hekdesh, holy, because it represented the people's support for the temple service. They couldn't touch it without washing their hands. When we eat a meal, we also view and approach the meal like a holy experience, and we take our cue from the Kohanim. Just like they wash their hands before eating, we do the same. Okay, so now, how do we define cooking? So this is very interesting. Look at Halacha. This is from Maimonides, the great Rambam. The Rambam says, look at Halacha 2. Rambam wrote, a person who places an egg next to a kettle so that it becomes slightly cooked is liable. It means they violated cooking on Shabbat if the egg becomes cooked. For a person who cooks with a derivative of fire is considered as if he cooked with fire itself. So this is a very important thing. What we see from here is that it doesn't matter what you do. It needs to involve fire. But even if you cook something in a weird way, in a not a classic kind of way, like by putting something in an oven, but somehow it gets it cooked, like those radiators over there, they can get pretty hot. If I come over to the radiator and I take a raw egg and I put it and eventually gets cooked, that's what the Rambam is teaching. It's about the result. Okay, it's not about the medium necessarily. And that's why, what's that?
Same with an electric stove.
100%. 100%. And that's why if a person who washes, it says, aged salted fish, which is a very thin, soft fish, with hot water is liable. Why? What if you put hot water over a raw steak? Or if you put hot water over a thin fish?
It'll cook.
One's cooking and one's not. Because why? Because it depends on what you're putting the hot thing. It depends what you're applying the heat to. If you apply the heat to something that's easily cooked, like thin fish, then that could be bishul. Bishul is the Hebrew word for cooking. If you put hot boiling water on a raw steak, it's not going to do anything.
You can't eat that steak because it's raw.
Right, I'm saying it's not changing the form of the steak. It's not cooking the steak.
Marinating is not cooking.
What is marinating?
Steak tartare.
Placing something in a solution that breaks down the...
No. Yeah. Cooking has to involve... Turn the page, guys. I'm gonna jump to this.
So ceviche is okay.
What's that?
Ceviche is okay.
I don't... You guys are so sophisticated.
Ceviche is like fish that is cooked in acid.
Right.
So you use like lime juice or lemon juice to cook the fish. It's safe to eat, but it's not the heat.
And why are you calling it cooked?
Because it chemically changed the fish. It breaks the acid, like... Changes the structure of the protein so you can eat it. Not
that's really interesting. Is it hot?
No.
Then it's not cooked.
Cool.
Cooking is a very... Everything... By the way, I'm using this as an example, guys. Every single one of the 39 acts of work has a precise definition. So you guys just both asked an excellent question because it seems like it's being cooked. People are calling it that. But people are calling, you know, moving a chair to the other... You know, work because that exertion of labor... So it's no different. It's the same. Question is, take a look at the definition. Page 2 on top. A is rendering a raw item edible via heat on Shabbat. Taking something which is raw and making it edible. And by the way, that's why edible, what's edible? So there's a big machloket. There's a debate between Rashi and the Rambam about what's edible. So they call it, there's this thing called machal ben drasai. Machal is food, ben drasai is a thief. Talmud speaks about it. Food for a thief.
you and I would not sit down. If we went to a nice restaurant, we would be like, take this back. It's not cooked. But a thief on the run, that'll be fine. Right? It's edible. It's not something you and I would probably eat. So there's a debate. Is it one third or one half? And this matters, actually. What is the definition? What's the biblical definition of cooking on Shabbat? Because if I cook a little, right? Assuming, right? So then, but I didn't render the raw item edible. Okay? It didn't get edible. I haven't cooked. And B, engaging in any activity which increases the characteristic of edibility. By the way, I developed this definition from...
Wouldn't that apply to the half-sitting cooking of some of the edible?
What's that?
Wouldn't that part B, would that make the prophecy he was talking about...
Oh, that's interesting.
An or an end?
Or.
Okay, yeah, no to be
engaging in an activity which increases the characteristic of edibility. So... What was the question? Except the only food, we're going to get to it soon. We're going to get to it tonight. But the only stuff you put on your blech is what?
Already cooked
food.
But doesn't it already increase its, like...
Well, it makes it nicer to eat. Okay. But it's... Right. You can, if it's still edible in a cold state, then it's not a problem.
What about preparing sushi?
Is that okay?
Slice the fish.
What's involved?
Slicing it.
That's fine.
Putting it onto rice.
Yeah. What are you like? I see them. I hate sushi.
Oh, but the seaweed gets wet. I mean, she uses it from like.
That doesn't matter.
I think
sushi is probably okay to make on Shabbos. Yeah. It seems from what I know about sushi making. Now, we're going to get to the other thing that Ethan was asking about because that's very relevant. How much material is required for Bishul? So this is from from Maimonides as well. A person who bakes an amount of food the size of a dried fig is liable. Just as a person is liable for baking bread, he's liable for food or herbs or for heating water. These are all one type of activity. The minimum amount of water for which one is liable for heating is an amount sufficient to wash a small limb. The minimum amount of herbs for which one is liable is the amount required to serve the purpose for which they're being cooked. So it's a very subtle malacha. It's not difficult to actually violate this, although it's got to be cooked for a certain amount of time, because it's got to take something from a raw state to an edible state. So a solid is like one third the size of an egg. Liquid, the amount sufficient to wash a small limb. Now, what about the level of heat required? How hot does the, let's say, water that you're cooking something in have to be in order for you to be in violation of cooking? So this is a very good term. You should know this. It's called yad soledetbo. Yad means a hand. Soledetbo, pull back. Recoil. Something that's so hot, that's why if you ever call a rabbi and you're like, you're not sure, did I mix that meat and milk? The first question the rabbi is going to ask is, was there, not, let's say there's no meat or milk per se, but it's like the vessels. Or there is meat and milk, but it wasn't hot. Okay, it wasn't hot. So they'll say, well, how hot does it have to be? Yad soledetbo. And there's a big debate, is that 110 degrees, 130? There's a lot of different, but it's basically the temperature at which, if you touched it, you pull back.
So if you're below that temperature, and you put food in it, and it makes the food more edible, even though you were below that temperature, it's still not cooking?
It's not cooking. That's true. Yeah.
And technically, the only prohibition is cooking meat in milk. Or, like, if you had a cold piece of cheese that was lying on top of...
Well, you can't eat the two things together, even if they're not cooked.
So you can just take off the cheese and sleep.
Yeah, correct. You could just clean off the meat and eat it, then, if there was no heat. The only issue is when there's heat. That's the first question any rabbi asks, is heat. And then they'll say, well, how much heat? And then the answer is, yad soledetbo. Heat enough that if you would, it would cause you to pull back. But and you're right, if it was... And we're going to talk about tea and coffee and all this fun stuff in a minute, okay? So there's three levels. So the Mishnah teaches, take a look in the middle of the page, level of change of the object, of the effect on the food. Anything that was placed into hot water that was cooked before Shabbos, you can soak it in hot water on Shabbos because it's already cooked. V'chol shelo ba b'chamin erev Shabbos, and anything that was not placed into hot water before Shabbos, you can rinse it only with hot water on the Shabbos, except for what? Aged salted fish, salted Spanish mackerel. Why? What's special about those types of fish? They're easily cooked. They're so easily cooked. Okay? So it's the same principle. You have to basically look how hot is the temperature and what are you actually trying to cook? Because if it's an easily cooked item, you could be in violation of cooking very easily. If it's a raw piece of meat and it's not so easily cooked, then not so simple to be in violation. Okay. Is this making sense, guys? Yeah? I'm going to make it more practical in a minute. Okay, so let's talk about... So we're not supposed to cook on Shabbos, basically. That's pretty simple. All right? What does it mean to cook on Shabbos? Taking something which was raw and making it edible. Now, what if you wanted to heat up something which was already cooked before Shabbat? Or... big scenario, you're running really late and you manage to put on the oven right before Shabbos. The food is raw in there, but you're not going to be cooking on Shabbos because you already put it on just a few minutes before Shabbos. Shabbos starts at 4 p.m. At 3:55, you stick it in the oven, you put it on. Is there an issue? Well, let me ask a question. Biblically, according to the Torah, have you cooked?
Doesn't it matter if it's a third
cook? I'm giving you the scenario. It's raw.
But if it can cook to one third in those 10 minutes, then I think you're okay.
Technically, but you still need a blech. You still need a blech.
Sorry, even because the stove is going to be on and you're just going to leave it
on. So there's another issue with the stoves. But I just want to get you. I want to give you guys the principle. Yeah. What is the issue? Is there an issue? Because the rabbi is always looking for possible issues that they want to prevent people from violating. What's the issue there?
With an oven or stove?
Oven. Or even a stovetop.
How are you going to turn off?
I'm going to leave it on the rest of Shabbos. Because I can't turn it off. You can't turn it on. Can't turn it off on Shabbos.
Can you have a non-Jew turn off after you take out the food?
What's that?
Can you have a non-Jew turn off after you take out the food?
Probably.
Only for safety reasons. Maybe for safety reasons. Maybe. But you're not answering my question. Can you leave the food cooking by itself over Shabbos? According to the Torah and according to the rabbis?
Yes.
Which one?
I think yes.
You think yes what?
You can leave it cooking over Shabbos.
According to the Torah or the rabbis?
You started the cooking process before Shabbos.
Right, because what's the definition of cooking? Right. Rendering a raw item edible on Shabbat.
Right.
But you have to engage in some sort of activity. And when was the activity engaged in?
For
Shabbos, so you haven't cooked.
But every moment that you leave it in the oven, you're allowing it to continue to cook.
You're allowing to cook. Is there a prohibition on that? Biblically.
No, but rabbinically.
So the rabbis came along, what were they concerned about, Hannah?
The smell is pleasing to the Lord.
The smell is pleasing, and maybe even to us? Okay, and what? What's the concern, guys? You're all like, this doesn't sound kosher.
Is there an issue that you could benefit from it if you were to eat that food?
But tell me, what's the issue? If I didn't engage in activity on Shabbat, I turned on the oven with the food there before Shabbat started. It cooked on its own.
But it's still being cooked after.
So? Shabbat. So?
You're going to start cooking on Shabbat.
There's no action.
You haven't engaged in that activity. So something happens on its own on Shabbat. I didn't do it on Shabbat. I did it before Shabbat.
Were you going to get the time wrong and start it too late?
So what's the concern? The concern is what? It's very practical.
You're going to touch the thing.
Why would you do that?
You're touching the same with the pen, like the equipment that's used for the thing.
Why? Why would you want to touch it? I'll let it cook itself. I won't do anything until it's fully cooked. I won't touch it.
You'll have to eat it eventually.
And what happens? What's the concern?
Mm-hmm.
You have company coming, right? And you're running late. And you let it go by itself. I'm not doing anything on Shabbos. The rabbis have this concern. It says in the Talmud, lest you come to stalk the coals.
There's no coals.
Yes, there are today. You'll hear in a second. Lest you come to stalk the coals. What are the coals? How did you make... Why would you come to stalk the coals? That just means increase the temperature.
No.
You know, you move, like a barbecue, you move the coals around to get things going more. Why would you do that? because you're running late, the company's coming over, and the concern is that this thing's not going to get cooked on time. So the rabbis created a safeguard, just like the pet. Because technically, and I just want you to understand, from a purely biblical perspective, you are not engaged in cooking if you set that thing on before Shabbos.
Joint.
Oh, no. We'll get to Joint. 1 second. I just want everyone to get this principle.
Is it creating a fire?
Guys, are you with me here? Miranda, Natasha, are you guys following this a little, kind of?
I don't know the answer to the question, but I'm intrigued
to hear it. Okay, no. So the concern is the rabbis were concerned that you might come to increase the flame. And what is the problem with increasing a flame on Shabbos?
Sprinkles.
What is that? That's one of the 39 acts of work.
Fire.
It's fires. Yeah. It's no different than creating a fire. Increasing a fire, decreasing it is all part of making a fire on Shabbos. So technically, from a Torah perspective, biblically speaking, you could leave food on to allow it to cook for itself. So that's where this little thing called the blech comes in. I don't know who came up with that name, because it sounds really weird, the blech. What does a blech do? Come on, guys, what does a blech do? You all seen a blech. It's a piece of sheet metal on top of the stove that's on top there. And you see in like these Orthodox households, all the stuff is like on top of this piece of sheet metal. Or I use a plug-in hot plate. That's also a blech, a hot plate. But you should get a hot plate without the dials. Just a plug-in one, without low, medium, and high. I'll tell you in a minute why. Some people used to think like we had a deal with one of the guys in the hardware store, trying to get in business and start changing the rules. What's the deal? How does that help? Because if the concern is what? Think like a Talmudist for a minute. If the concern is that I'm going to what? That I might come to turn it up, then what I'll do is I'll just have a reminder. I'll have something there that will remind me not to turn it up, and that's really what a blech is.
Because blech covers the knobs as well.
So there's a machloket, there's a debate. Should the blech cover the heat source or the control knobs?
It covers both.
Different rabbis say different. Some people have both. That's why sometimes you'll see a blech, a piece of sheet metal like this, and then it'll come down to cover the knobs. Or, I think it's easier, just make sure you get a good extension cord, if you're using an extension cord, to just use a hot plate. Now, why is it not a problem with a hot plate?
There's no knobs. Yeah.
There's no knobs, and therefore the hot plate is really just to heat things that are already cooked. Mm-hmm. It's not to cook things.
Yeah.
And the reason we don't like the low, medium, and high, or some rabbis don't, is because that kind of makes it more into a cooking implement. Mm-hmm. So now, there's a second concern. Rabbinic concern number one is we might come to stalk the coals. Fix that with a blech. How does that help you, the blech? Just reminds you that at Shabbos, don't increase the flame. There's another thing. We don't want to engage the second thing. Take a look. It says, 1 second. Yeah, turn the page. Look at rabbinic enactments on page 3. It's called Mechse Kemivasho. Looks as though one is cooking. The concern is what if I can I just leave a flame on my stove over Shabbat? And then I'm going to take food I already cooked, and I want to heat it up. It's in the fridge. Let's say a piece of chicken, a piece of kugel. And I want to eat that. I want to heat it up. Can I just put it on the stove already? Biblically, yes. Why yes? It's already been cooked. It's already been cooked. I need some water. Give me 1 second, guys.
I don't have COVID. Don't get nervous.
Nobody gets sick of anything else anymore. I just know whether I have anything else.
Thank you for that nice amen. Alright, so what does that mean? Merci, it looks like I'm cooking. In other words, I have a flame. I put the flame on from before Shabbat. I cook the food from before Shabbat. I just want to heat it up a little. Why can't I just put the the previously cooked chicken, take it out of the fridge and put it on the stovetop with a little flame there, heat it up.
Because your kids will see you doing that and think it's okay to cook on Shabbat.
So that is actually, there's a very subtle difference between what you just described, which is called Maris Ayin. Same reason I don't go into McDonald's to get a Coke, even though the Coke at McDonald's is no different than Deli Kasba, right? Because someone might, or the Rambam explains it, that you don't want to engage in activity that so closely resembles the prohibited activity, because when you get used to doing things that look so similar, you might actually do the prohibited thing itself. That's another category of rabbinic. You're getting into the whole rabbinic world now. This is what the rabbis did. Not to drive ourselves crazy, but to make sure what? Why were they doing this? Why did they create these prohibitions? But they gave us solutions, by the way. The blech answers both. The blech reminds us that it's Shabbos, not to increase the flame. And the blech makes it look like not the regular... It doesn't look like I'm cooking. Because you can't see the flame. It covers up the flame. And same thing with a hot plate. Can't see the flame. And that prevents it but it's not. It's a little different. It's not like we're concerned what other people are going to think. We are sometimes. That's not this. We're concerned about performing an activity that so closely resembles the prohibited activity.
So you don't have a blech, and you're trying to do something like, you know, making some Shabbos food, leaving something on the flame. Just as long as you know that it's Shabbos, or you don't need a blech.
You need a blech. It won't work without a blech. You can't really heat up food that was previously cooked before Shabbat without a blech.
Because even if you don't touch the flame and you leave it exactly on low.
Yeah. Now, you won't be in violation of anything biblical, but you'll be in violation of the rabbinic who created they didn't create, those issues are there, but they're concerned about those issues, so therefore they suggest we use the blech.
What about leaving things in the oven?
Yeah, what about like Shabbos mode on an oven?
Okay, so... The regular ovens without a Shabbos mode are an issue, because why?
Why?
What happens when you open up your oven?
The lights turn on.
Besides the light. Let's say you can disassemble the light.
The
light.
The heat will kick on.
The temperature changes.
Temperature changes. Why? Because the air, cold air comes in, causes the thermostat to go wild, and then it pumps more... what is a pump? Gas. Okay, basically. And you are causing... you are indirectly causing it to... So that's why we don't really use the insides of our ovens on Shabbat at all. You asked about the Shabbos mode. So I don't even know.
See, that's, I don't like really understand what it is. I feel like it's kind of a farce.
No, I think it's been...
I've never had an oven that has one, but...
We have like a draw down below.
Like a warming drawer.
A warming draw. Yeah. All it is just like, there's no flame there.
Right.
And it's just like heated up a little. So it doesn't look like you're cooking, and then it just warms things up a little.
I mean,
it's like a blech.
Right.
No different than a blech, really. It's the same thing. It's like a hot plate.
Yeah.
Just part of your stove.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't know this, that when you open up your oven, now if you know your oven really, really well, and you can get in there really quick,
yeah,
there might be a way of figuring out how to open it quickly, pull out the stuff. No, the concern is not right or left. The concern is that the cold air causes the thermostat to burn more fuel. And that's the concern. Then you're involved. Then you're increasing the flame.
You always have like Jaffman in a little pot.
Okay, so because that's probably that. Probably
when you put it in before Shabbat, it's dough. It's raw dough. You let it cook overnight, like Shulman. And you take it out. And it's hot on Shabbat.
That's great. But is the oven on Shabbat?
I think it's.
Maybe the issue is like when you take something out, you shouldn't put it back in.
Because
then if you take something out and you let the cold air in and then the temperature changes, like there's no food going, there's going to be.
You could do that. It's like a trick you can only pull off once.
Right.
You could, if you're only pulling it out, not putting something back in, the problem is when you open up the oven, it's not about cooking. What happens?
Kindling a fire.
You're increasing the flame.
Because
the cold air comes in, even if we're only using it once.
Right.
Like this is such a common practice.
No, that's why you're here to learn. There's a lot of stuff done in people's homes.
Do you have a non-Jew microwave for you on Shabbat?
Not really, no. You can't really have someone who isn't Jewish. By the way, we we're subject to a lot of these things here. This, we have a kitchen here, and we have hot food coming out. There's all these issues. Always, we have a hot plate in the kitchen. We have a warmer, and we can't have Jerry do anything that you and I can't do. Now, when we'll discuss this next week or the week after, when we have our class about non-Jewish help. I don't want to get there right now, because it's a whole other set of principles.
So nobody using microwave.
No, no. I mean, no. I don't think so. Yeah, by the way, please don't get put off. I'm sure a number of us here are not necessarily in keeping with all these rules and laws. I'm not trying to make a judgment on what you're doing, what you're not doing. This is what I'm just trying to give you, like the system of what it is, and just trying to give you the principles. So that's the electric hot plate, the crock pot. What about liquids? What's the deal with liquids? Oh, I'll get to coffee and tea in a minute. Meaning,
you didn't get into the crock pot thing. Like if
okay.
If it's a constant temperature the whole time, it's okay. So like an electric thing that sits there at a particular temperature all through Shabbat that you don't turn off, that's okay.
If it also needs a blech for the same reason. A crock pot should also have a blech, which is simple. You can just take a little piece of tin foil, cover the knob, or take a piece of tin foil and, you know, in between the crock and the pot. You know what I mean?
Hot liners. I've seen those.
No, that's a lot. That's just so things don't stick.
So as long as you don't have access to the controls.
Huh?
As long as you don't have access to the controls.
Or the heat source is a debate. I follow the heat source opinion, but some people do the controls. Either one is fine. Because you have the same issue. You have the same issue. You might come to increase the flame.
Even if it's under the tinfoil.
No. Then you don't have that issue. Then you have a blech and you're fine. I'm explaining why a crock pot needs a blech also. Does anyone follow that? You guys know what I'm talking about?
I'm talking about just taking tin foil and putting it over
there. Allie, yeah.
What did they do before the invention of crock pots and everything? Like stoves? Did they just eat cold food on Shabbat?
No. Same exact stuff. They had blechs.
Before that, over a fire?
Yeah, they had a fire. They would leave a fire on and they'd put the... I mean, even I remember growing up before, like my mother, bless her memory, she never used a hot plate. Then later on, she got it when it came out and it was getting safer. But we always had like a little flame on with a piece of sheet metal over it. That's probably what they did back then, something to that effect, yeah. Now, everything we've been saying so far has to do with dry foods. Because the Talmud says, I love this phrase, ein bishul achar bishul. Bishul's cooking. There's no cooking after cooking. What does that mean? Like, you can't kill somebody twice. Right? So once somebody is dead, they're finished. You can't kill them a second time. No double jeopardy, right? So, what about... is that the same for a solid versus a liquid? Think about the properties of a solid versus a liquid. What do you guys think? What's the difference between a solid and a liquid when you heat it up?
Like a bubble, right?
Well, that in other words, cooking is defined for a liquid as boiling. Whatever the boiling temperature, that's true, bubbling. But what happens when a liquid cools down? This is why you won't find chicken soup. This is why you won't find religious Jews eating chicken soup on Shabbos lunch, but you will Friday night. Because you can't really heat up. Or can't you heat up?
Liquid.
Why? Why is a liquid different? But you can heat up chicken and kugel. What's the difference between chicken soup and kugel? I mean...
You, evaporates.
What?
Evaporates.
Okay, but what? And then when you put it in the fridge? Let's say you made chicken soup Friday night. You make chicken soup and then you ate it Friday night. You know what? It was so delicious. Let's put it in the fridge.
And then the fat also changes the state too. The fat goes from liquid to a solid.
Okay, very good. The state changes as opposed to what? Let's say a piece of chicken or kugel. What happens to it? It's the same thing. It stays the same. It's just cold. The only thing that changes is the temperature. The constitution of the actual food remains the same. Not so with liquids, which is why we say, ein bishul achar bishul. There's no cooking after cooking by davar yavesh. Yavesh means dry. But yesh bishul achar bishul, but there is cooking after cooking by a davar lach for a liquid. You know when I say there is cooking after cooking by a liquid? Like you cook something, cool it down. Heating that thing up again is what? Cooking. Because what is really cooking when it comes to a liquid? It's heating it up to a certain temperature. What is cooking for a solid? Cooking for a solid is not simply heating it up. It changes the form. And therefore, when you put it, but when it cools down, it stays the same form. And therefore, you can heat it up again. So there's a big distinction, which is why you won't find, in religious homes, you won't find soup usually served for lunch. But you will Friday night. Yeah.
But if this was about, like, fat congealing in the chicken soup, like, what if you had a vegetarian soup?
No, it's the same issue. If it's liquid, let's say you cooked it before Shabbat and you had it Friday night and you have leftovers, you want to serve it for lunch the next day. You put it in the fridge. And then now you want to heat it up, so you put it on the blech. What's happening to that soup? Actually, what's happening, you have to really get into the molecules and the things. Something is changing. Okay, what's that?
They move.
They move.
The molecules
move. Now, it doesn't happen in solids. Okay. That's the difference.
What about if you just warm it up and don't make it
hot? If you're just taking the chill off, that's what you want to say. Just taking the chill off is okay, because what did we say before? It has to get to, in order for you to be in violation of cooking, it has to be so hot that, so if you're just taking the chill off, that's okay.
Okay.
So let's talk about coffee and tea, and then we'll finish up.
I have one really quick.
Yeah, please. Yeah. Now, here's the question. If it's a hot plate without dials and it's dry, previously cooked before Shabbat food, the answer is yes. You can put it back on and off, doesn't matter. If it's a piece of sheet metal over your flame, then there's a difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. The Sephardim hold that anywhere on that blech is fine to put your hot food, back and forth. The Ashkenazim say only the periphery of that, because the Ashkenazim poskim feel that piece of sheet metal over the stovetop is not a sufficient heker, like it's not recognizable enough that you're not cooking. Only on the periphery, they would say, it's permissible. So it depends what kind of blech you have. That's why I tell people the easiest thing is to get a hot plate, a plug-in hot plate. And by the way, those suckers get really hot. They'll get everything you want to have hot on that you can heat up on Shabbat, which is dry. And it works. I mean, they're pretty simple. Right, I know, I should get 10%. Yeah. I know. By the way, there's one rabbi in Riverdale, Rabbi Willig, is a big rabbi of YU, and he came out when they came out with just plug-ins. They had plug-ins and they had low meat and high. He told everyone, just get the plug-ins. And everyone was running to the hardware stores getting, and they were like selling like hotcakes. Because he has like a big congregation. So they were selling like hot plates.
You can't melt things like chocolate, right?
What's that?
Can you melt something off?
Can you melt something on Shabbos?
Well, ice goes from ice to liquid.
Yeah.
You're not chocolate.
You're
not melting it if you're putting ice in a glass with water.
Wait, what is
the natural?
Let's say you have like chocolate that could be melted if you heat up.
That's a problem because it's going to turn into a liquid.
You can't do it.
No, that you can't. But what were you saying about the ice?
Well, if you were to put ice in a glass,
yeah, that's okay.
Definitely not causing a chemical reaction. Although if you had water, you would be.
That's okay. That's fine. It's still not cooking. There's no heat. Yeah. It has to involve heat.
Wait, so you can't melt the chocolate that way?
You cannot melt the chocolate.
Let's just say you have some chocolate chip cookies.
Yes.
And
by the way, this is also the thing. I thought you were all going to ask me. The obvious question is, how do you know when something is a solid?
Whoa.
How do you know when something is a solid or a liquid?
Yeah.
Sometimes you think it's going to be a gas and it comes out of liquid. Ever had that? That's an allergy joke. That's an allergy joke.
What's the difference? No, seriously. We have stuff all the time. What about gravy? Because the liquid you're not supposed to heat up. So the answer is 51%. As long as 51% of the dish is solid, you can consider the whole dish solid. What's that?
Cholent.
That's why cholent, yeah.
If it's like didn't come out solid as you hoped.
Right, it's a little more liquidy.
Add more beans.
Right.
All
right.
Can you put ice in
a
hot soup to cool it down?
Oh, good question. Can you put ice in your hot soup? Now, we got to talk about coffee and tea, and we'll answer this question now. What's the issue with putting ice in a hot soup? Think about it.
Like some
else? It's treason, but
temperature. Of what?
The soup. And ice.
Well, it's okay to cool it something down. But what's the problem with the ice? You're heating, you're cooking the ice. Okay, now, let's talk about, let's talk about tea and coffee. You with me here? How do you make coffee on Shabbos?
Coffee.
You go to MJE early.
Oh, I have to tell you a cool coffee story. Come to MJE early. Coffee.
Automatic timer.
Okay, I'm going to talk about freshly brewed coffee. There's a way of having freshly brewed coffee on Shabbos. It's called a timer. And a blech. And I was on a rabbinic conference with 40 other rabbis, and we went to Baltimore. And we went to Rev Heinemann, who's the head of the Starkey, one of the national, international kashrut organizations, and I was sitting there with four of the other rabbis, and he went out and he told everyone, he goes, someone say, can I use a coffee machine if I set it up to a timer and put a blech on it? Yeah. You went like, yeah, that's fine. And the place went wild. They're like, what do you mean? How could you? So he leaned forward, I remember, he's a very wise man, he said, he points to one, he goes, what's the name of your coffee machine? He says, Keurig. He says, last time I checked the Torah, there's no prohibition for Keurig to cook on Shabbos. Last time I checked, it was a prohibition for a Jew to cook on Shabbos. Is your coffee machine cooking? Yeah. So, but you did, you said it from before Shabbos. So, by the way, we did this for years. This is Rabbi Pinney's thing. He's crazy about having freshly brewed coffee on Shabbos. So you could actually do that. You could, as long as you set it from before Shabbat, put it on a timer, and put a blech, which
over
means
wait.
You just cover the knob. You cover the knob with a piece of tin foil. And you can have freshly brewed coffee if you set it on the timer. You can't do anything. You just have to let it go. Like 7 a.m., all of a sudden the coffee is going to go, and it's going to, yeah.
But that sort of contradicts from the start of the class when you said with modern age, with all these timers, we can really.
I'm not saying you should.
Circumvent the.
Yeah, you can. You can. But here's the difference. So who can articulate? Jason is bringing up an issue. What's the difference between that? And let's say setting your TV to go on at a certain time. So now you're getting to the spirit of Shabbat. If having a nice cup of coffee in the morning is going to add to the oneg, to your enjoyment of Shabbos. After all, we do eat all these delicacies and foods to enjoy Shabbat. So I love coffee. So I'm going to do that. But like a show or something like that, which is not really sort of like... Now, I will admit it. This is gray. You're getting into a very gray area because technically speaking, you could have a TV set from before Shabbat and then watch it. It's not in the spirit of Shabbat. I remember when I was a kid, like my friends who were obsessed with like ball games would be standing in front of like these stores with the TV in the store to get the score, you know, like, and they weren't doing anything technically wrong. It's not like you walk by some guy playing music on the street, you have to cover your ears.
You have to cover your ears?
No, you don't. I'm saying you don't. I'm trying to make that point. Because you're not involved in doing the activity, but it's...
Can you benefit from it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. All right, let me finish. How do we cook? How do we make coffee, though? Let's say you're not going to do this freshly brewed thing.
I have no idea.
Okay, so... So if you want... Or tea. Let's do tea also. Let's do tea. Simple. What happens if I go over the... The hot urn is always over there. I'm pointing it because I see the hot urn there. I go over with my cup... And I have a tea bag in the cup, and I open up the spigot. The water was cooked from before Shabbat. You can't plug it in on Shabbos. You have to cook that water before Shabbat. What's the problem with me just pouring hot water on the tea bag?
Tea leaves are not cooked.
Tea leaves are not cooked, and therefore you're cooking. That is biblical cooking. Big, big no-no. So how do I have hot tea on Shabbos? So the Talmud tells us, a kli sheni ina mevashel, a second cup is not considered cooking. Here. And this is what we do. Because tea leaves are so easily cooked, we use what's called a third vessel. So here's what you do. Let's say this is the Kli Rishon. Kli Rishon is the first vessel. That's the vessel in which the food, the water is boiled. That's the urn. Okay? I pour a little here. This is hot water. It's very, very hot water. I take, this is the second vessel. That's the first vessel. The first vessel is always defined as... Ethan, what's the first vessel defined as, always? Now, the Kli Rishon, the first vessel is defined as something that the thing is cooked in. It's what's cooked in. Pour it into the second vessel. Pour the second vessel into the third. and now you're good to put your tea bag in here. Same thing with instant coffee or hot chocolate or anything like that. What you don't want to do is you don't want to put the tea bag in the first vessel. You don't want to pour the first vessel's hot water onto the tea bag or the coffee. You want to put it in at least the second and preferably the third. The reason for the third is because tea leaves are so easily cooked that we want to, you know, distance it a little more. Yeah.
Rabbi, so I've heard that for tea it's true, but then I've heard there's a debate with coffee.
Because it's previously cooked.
Yeah.
So if the coffee was previously cooked, then just put it in a second vessel and you're fine. True.
Yeah.
Same thing with hot oatmeal, if it was previously cooked as well. Yeah, Hannah.
So I do this, right, like every Shabbat, and I always feel kind of silly because I feel like I don't know, like, at the end of the day, I'm still having freshly brewed tea. So, right. Like, you know what I mean? So
you have to divorce yourself.
It's symbolic to me, which is fine, like, in some ways that has meaning in and of itself, right? But, like, I'm curious, like...
It's not symbolic. It's that you're not engaged in the activity of cooking. Even though it looks and feels and tastes like you're enjoying a cooked food, and like you've done that, it doesn't really matter because, like any legal system, it's about the definitions of the activities that go into whatever the malacha that we're discussing. And tonight we were discussing bishul, cooking. What does it mean to cook tea leaves? What it means is to pour.
Cooking them, maybe if you're using a third.
Not in the third vessel. We have a tradition that I could try to explain it more biochemically. This is the first vessel where the heat was on there.
Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't have the same impact in the second and even less in the third vessel.
So you're losing heat.
You're losing heat, 100%. You
so
are.
You could take...
Even though it tastes the same. I hear you, and it's turning it a color, and it feels like you're just cooking.
Yeah.
I get it.
So could you take a cliché knee...
Second vessel.
And then pour it on raw fish?
No. If you put raw fish in the second, you probably could, because cliché knee in a mevashel. But raw fish you can't. Lightly salted fish, which gets cooked too easily, is no different than tea leaves. There are a couple of things called kalei hamavashel, things that are easily cooked. The Mishnah actually lists a few things and mentions thin salted fish.
Right.
Thin salted fish gets very easily cooked, so you have to be careful, just like a tea leaf.
So it's the same status as a tea leaf. I could use a second
cup
or a third cup. A third
cup. Yeah, you could.
Put in technically.
Well, if you put that in there, yeah. Yeah.
And then I just
want to
have some wet.
Yeah, Ellie.
Can you pour instant coffee into hot water and mix it in its coffee?
In other words, what you do is you take the hot water, take your coffee. It's already been cooked, right?
It's like a powder instant coffee.
Yeah, so the best thing is actually to put the hot water first and then put the instant coffee after.
Into
the second vessel. You don't need a third vessel if it's previously cooked coffee. Instant coffee is all cooked before, is that?
Yeah,
so then you're okay. You don't need the third vessel.
Hot water, tablespoon, right? That's just the same.
You're fine. Yeah, but you're right. You're just not putting it in the first vessel. The first vessel is the urn.
So technically, you never would be.
That's very confusing.
You wouldn't pour the coffee.
You would never pour the coffee.
Well, what don't you get? It's just for the teas.
Like, it's nothing different than you would usually do, right? Tablespoon of hot water. That's it, yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess...
Right.
The practicality, there's nothing different than you would usually
do. The only thing
oh, that's right.
The first vessel.
What's the vessel? It's like the urn.
The urn. Some people like to have a coffee urn.
Yeah.
Like when you open up, you can't do that on Shabbat. You can't have your coffee urn. You have to have just the water, and then you put the water in another vessel, the second vessel, with the coffee.
Like your coffee mug, right?
Exactly.
So you don't need to put it in a... So for coffee, you can just do urn to your mug and then put the coffee right in.
Okay.
So I've been doing an extra step. It's okay.
Yeah, and... it's okay. And then for tea, you need a third step.
Okay.
Yes, go.
Right, it's 9:15.
Yeah.
Can we also go back to the chocolate chip cookies on the bluff?
Okay, we'll talk about it after. You had a question?
Can you open a container on Shabbat?
So there's a debate about it. I think it's okay.
Like a can.
The only issue is some people say that you might be inadvertently creating a vessel. But we do. We can open up a can on Shabbos.
So we can?
Oh. What about tearing a package? Like,
you can, just not through the lettering. Jason?
Could you recommend any authoritative books on Shabbos?
On the cooking stuff? There's a great one in the back. I'll show it to you. I'll show it to you right now.
Also.
And I'm saying there's a great art scroll book on cooking.
Yeah.
on all this.
Well, I'm actually interested in like the whole of all
melachot. Oh, so you've got the best thing on all the melachot right over there is that gray 4-volume set, Rabbi Rabiad.
It's like. Here it is. It's not great. This 4-volume.
Yeah.
It's so well done. It gives all the definitions and a million examples, and it's got all 39 acts of work. It's really well done.
It's in called.
It's called the 39 Malachot.
It's in print.
Take a picture. What's that? Yeah, it's in print.
Okay.
Take a picture before you go. If anybody wants to get it, really want to be like more of an expert in this stuff, it's a really good thing to have in your library.
How come you can tear a package and not toilet paper?
Food, because there's a heter for food.
It's the purpose of tearing.
Because you can't. It's there are other things that seem to be permissible when it's connected to food, but it can't be for later. It can't be like I'm going to tear a bag now for after Shabbos. It has to be like food you're eating right now.
Well, like let's say there's a you forgot to open the package of plastic forks.
If you're using the forks on Shabbos, it's okay. It's fine. It's also an act of destruction. Remember we discussed last week. You're not creating something new. The issue with opening up a can or something like that, some people think. That it might be creating a vessel. By the way, I'm going to take back the can.
You're going to like drink out of a can, which nobody does.
You could.
You could.
You can destroy, tear through the metal.
It's just that you're creating. Some people say you can't open this on Shabbat, or a regular soda bottle.
You have to open it pre-Shabbat.
But now we don't. I don't follow that. It's a little more of a stricture because it's like inadvertently creating
you can never
a.
Open wine.
What's that?
And you could never open wine either.
Yeah, according to those people, yeah.
Could you not open a bottle of wine then?
It's the same principle.
Cork is separate, even more right.
What's the difference, Rabbi Pinney, opening up a bottle of soda,
yeah.
Which some people say creates a kli if you open it,
yeah.
And a bottle of wine? Nobody says you can't open a bottle of wine on Shabbos.
Because here, like this can, I have a can of shelter here, as a convenient example. According to some, this already is a vessel. You're not creating anything. The fact that question is, isn't making the opening for you to access the stuff, is that creating a new utility and therefore it's like a new vessel? But the cork is just something which is just it's not a permanent part of it. It's not really sealed.
So a bottle.
The same like, thing with a bottle too. Then.
What do you mean?
With a regular bottle of soda. Why
so
does someone
say it's because you're going to break that the. Since it's sealed, when you crack it, you have a ring, so it becomes like a functional cap or the.
By the way, these are notes when you and I learned Bishul.
Well, how many years ago was that?
A long time ago.
And when you say can opener to go
in the basement in Rabbi Chait's yeshiva.
30 years ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. We were like kids. Okay. Yeah, we're going to stop. I want to leave some time for Rabbi Pinney. Do you have some announcements?
Yeah.
Or go for it, please.
Hi, everyone.
Thank you all for joining, everyone.
Thanks for joining. Some announcements.